Dude, we are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
The independence case is a powerful one.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I'm delighted to be joined by a consummate freelance professional, great fan of Doctor Who, and the co-author, alongside Tom Phillips, of an excellent new book, Conspiracy Theories, a history of bollocks theories, and how not to fall for them, John Elledge. Welcome back to the podcast, John.
Hey, Will. Thank you very much for having me. Good to be here.
It's great to have you on again. The last time that you were on the podcast, I think Theresa May was still Prime Minister, and we're going to be heading for very soon her second successor. So it's been a while since you've last been on.
I'm sort of impressed by the podcast staying power. You know, if you've been going like for 3 or 4 years, that's quite a long lifespan for a podcast these days, isn't it?
So
you
know, it is.
Congratulations, well done.
Thank you. But the first question that I'd like to ask in relation to the book is, what was it that made you and Tom decide that you wanted to write a book about conspiracy theories?
I don't know what's the origin story, really. It was originally Tom's thing. Put it that way. Tom and I have the same agent and the same publisher, this is sort of the third in a very successful series he's done. The first two of which are Humans: A Brief History of How We Fucked It All Up. And the second of which is Truth: A Brief History of Total Bullshit. So you can see very much where the form comes in. But they were really keen to get a third in the series. He was at the time editing a website called Full Fact. I was kind of plugged into it to give a bit of help. Because he was rather busy. There was a lot of fact checking going on in 2020. I was looking for another project, and Tom and I have known each other for a long time. It'd be great, and it was great working together. But I think the idea of the book in and of itself was just because, I mean, looking around the world in 2019, 2020, there was quite a lot of conspiracy theories coming to the fore and affecting things in quite a big way. It was kind of conceived of, I think, during the first phase of the pandemic. So obviously we'd seen a lot of stuff about, you know, is 5G giving people COVID? Or there was a story about, which we've got in the book, the story of black helicopters popping by at a particular time every evening to kind of spray with like antivirals or something, which is interesting because that's, you know, black helicopters are obviously sort of a feature of conspiracy lore going back decades, but normally they're the bad guys. It was sort of interesting seeing a conspiracy theory spreading that in which they're suddenly the goodies and they're going around like helping cure people of COVID. So between that and Donald Trump kind of in the run into his re-election campaign, and all the stuff around Brexit and everything, it just very much felt like a moment, I think, in which this was a very big feature of politics on both sides of the Atlantic and indeed elsewhere. So something that isn't in the book because it's a bit weird and pathetic, as I realised halfway through writing it, I had got sucked into a conspiracy rabbit hole a few years ago.
Oh wow!
But the reason it's not The reason this didn't lead to any sort of radicalization or anything is because it's the most pathetic of conspiracy theories you can imagine, which is there was a rumor going around that someone had found most of the missing episodes of Doctor Who.
Oh, God, yeah, I remember that.
You remember this? I thought you might be a bit of a fan. And it turned out this guy, Philip Morris, and it turned out there was something at the root of it. This guy had discovered 9. Yeah. Out of the 106 it was at that point, I think, which is, you know, that's the biggest haul in decades.
Yeah.
But just thinking back, I can see exactly the mechanisms by which people would kind of speculate something and then someone else could repeat it and it would gradually solidify into fact.
Yeah.
So you'd read this rumour and then like 2 weeks later you'd read something else and you'd think, oh, that's great, that's the second source. But it wasn't. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
You could just see it bouncing around the internet. And it got to this point that, like, genuinely, like, this guy came out with 9 episodes and everyone went, oh, that's rubbish. Yeah, and it's not quite a conspiracy exactly, but it is that exact same dynamic.
Yeah.
How the internet has kind of sped this stuff up and enabled it to fuck everyone up at a far more effective rate than previously.
I mean, I really remember that at the time because there was two articles that I wrote about it at the time that was related to a specific subcategory of that conspiracy theory, which was that there were a load of missing episodes that a mate of Ian Levine's had found in Taiwan, and that they were for some reason stored there, and that the guy who owned them wasn't going to show them, or there was some sort of like really rambling thing about it. So I thought, this is a bit weird. I'll see if they did actually broadcast Doctor Who at any time in one of the American military bases in Taiwan. I had a look and I got in contact with someone who was an ex-service person there. And he said, yeah, no, we didn't have any British TV at all in Taiwan. And yet it had spread across some of the message boards. I think it was like on Planet Mondas for quite a while, that there were these cache of episodes that this guy who was a mate of Ian Levine's had found there.
But the problem was there was just enough possible truth to this for it to not be completely not like I can't remember the details, but I'm pretty sure there have been episodes that have turned up in places they should not have been.
Yeah.
And we don't and nobody has the paperwork. So it's like whether they were sent ahead is like, do you want to buy this or something? Yeah. But they were never actually shown in these countries. So it wasn't completely crazy.
Oh,
no. But I just remember, do you follow
Jim Smith? Yes. Yeah.
He's a good mate of mine. He, when this first came out, and someone on a mailing list, there was this gossip and they went away and came back and said, okay, here are the two rooms I've been able to find. And we all went kind of fucking mental for it. And this was on a Friday night when I was at one of my oldest friends, Stag Dudes, by the way, and I was back corner. reading forum posts about 60 episodes of Doctor, because I'm that cool. So this guy repeated the rumor, and then away and kind of fact check it, sort of ran it again, like basically looked at who bought what and came back and said, okay, it sort of fits with this country, it fits with this country, I think it's this one.
Yeah.
And that kind of that thing where that felt like a form of confirmation, but it wasn't. It was like probably what had happened was the original solid piece of information was this guy Philip Morris is looking for episodes in Zambia or whatever it was, and off the back of that someone had gone away and come up with a list of possible episodes he had found, and then that had gone round, seen it and looked at it and gone, right, it's Zambia, clearly it's entire. And do you see what I mean, that different bits kind of confirm each other, but actually there's only, you can see how it all kind of grows out of one solid piece of information.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about the period that we're talking about, 2019, 2020, and more recent times, in terms of conspiracy theories, is that you have this massive event, as you say, the pandemic occurring, that really seemed to... I think make people feel much more vulnerable. And one of the things that you point out in the book is that often people rely on conspiracy theories when they feel particularly vulnerable, when they feel that they need something to explain what's happening in the world, to give them a sort of a system of beliefs or an explanation as to why one event or another is occurring. Do you think that that's one of the real generators, one of the real furnaces for conspiracy theories when we have major global events like the pandemic, like a world war, that sort of make people who might not have necessarily been interested in conspiracy theories or engaged with them much more want to, because something is happening that is so out of their sphere of understanding that they have to grasp for something that seems to answer it?
Yeah, so one of the bits I did a lot of work on in the book was quite early on, we've got a chapter about the psychology of conspiracy theories. Mm. And I did a lot of reading on for that. And one of the things I came across a chap called Michael Shermer, who is founder, I think, of the American Skeptic Society, came up with a couple of words meaning a couple of concepts that he thinks kind of explain conspiracy theories, one of which is patternicity, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's basically the ability of the human brain to spot patterns. And you know, if you know, the examples I always give are, you know, spotting the slight change in the weather, that means a storm is coming and you should take precautions, or spotting the change in a light pattern at the corner of your eye, that means there's a predator in the bushes. You know, if the animals that can kind of make those connections are going to have an evolutionary advantage over those that can't. And the other one is a thing called agenticity, which is the same, but, like, you know, if there is an effect, there must be a conscious agent behind it. So that, like, you know, you can see the sort of Greek gods in that, you know, if there's a storm, there must be someone creating the storm, or, you know, if the crops have failed, it's because we've not been building our temples. But you can also see that in conspiracy theories, like, there has been a major economic downturn, my business is gone, my home is at risk, someone is behind this. Maybe it's those Jesuits who I've never really liked very much. You know, it's, you know, both of these are kind of useful concepts in terms of making sense of the world, but they can get too developed. You know, it's because sometimes we see patterns that aren't there, or sometimes we are imputing motive where there is only kind of chance. I mean, if you think about the COVID pandemic, which you've already kind of touched on, if you think about that, the most likely explanation for it is simply the random mutations in some viruses somewhere in a bat in Wuhan or wherever. You know, it's just, and the brain can't really get your head around that.
Yeah.
It's sort of easier to comprehend the idea that someone was doing this deliberately, either as a bioweapon or as, you know, just kind of like mucky about scientifically to see what they were doing. But the idea that someone is somewhere is pressing a button that made this happen is kind of an easier concept to understand than that a million tiny chances happen to have paid off in this direction. So I think this is a very long roundabout answer to your question, but I think I think the desire to feel in control obviously kind of leans on these things quite a lot. It's because if you understand why something is happening, that does give you a sense of control over it. Even if you can't fight back, it does kind of mean, like, you sort of know who is behind it. You know, there is a theoretical possibility of fighting back. There's a theoretical possibility of change. Whereas if it's just random chance and stuff happens, how do you deal with that? It's really difficult to kind of see where you begin.
So
I think people do in times of stress, they are more likely to start seeing patterns and agents that aren't there. And conspiracy theories are an outgrowth of that.
One of the things I also think is interesting in the book is that certain conspiracy theories tend to be believed by people of particular political persuasions because they fit into their already pre-existing system of belief. Do you think that this is something that, when we're looking at populists in particular, it's easier to sort of define them not just as sort of like populists in general, but as right-wing or left-wing populists based on the kind of conspiracy theories that they feed into? Because there does seem to be sort of a distinction between some of the conspiracy theories that are believed by people on the left and those who believed by people on the right.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think there's a number of reasons why people in different political tendencies would believe different conspiracy theories. One of which is that obviously different theories will be convenient to them, or more likely to, you know, are literally convenient to them in terms of making the arguments they want to make, or in terms of shoring up their existing beliefs. So one of the things I came across suggested that right-wing Americans are more likely to believe conspiracy theories about the government wanted to come take your guns or something, whereas left-wing ones are more likely to be conspiracies about, you know, evil corporations, for example. And you could, you know, you can see exactly how both of those groups get there, because those are the things that are, that already accord with what they already think. But also, I think there are other factors, such as just, you know, filter bubbles. Mm. So, like, the information that you are exposed to is more likely to include particular conspiracy theories, or the kind of reinforcing the reinforcement in your beliefs you get from a sort of social media feedback loop, where, like, you know, if you say a particular thing, everyone on your side will cheer, and everyone on the other side will get angry, you know, you get a rush of endorphins. It's, yeah, you know, you can see exactly why people keep pressing that button.
Yeah.
Than that. And particularly conspiracy theories will fit into that. But also, you were talking about populism on the left and right. I think it is also worth noting that you don't need any of those things for a political group to kind of get sucked into a conspiracy theory. Mm. I think actually one of the, there is also a centrist conspiracy theory, mm-hmm, that came across, which is the idea of Cambridge Analytica, this political consultancy, having somehow swung the Brexit referendum, mm-hmm, all by itself, essentially, which we did some polling. We found out that is believed by a lot of Lib Dems and by 48% of all Remainers. And there is no evidence of this whatsoever. I mean, it's, mm-hmm, just, these guys went around claiming they could do that, but but everyone who worked with them said, yeah, they're a bunch of shysters, basically. It's basically like, you know, a bunch of, everyone has believed their PR, because it is easier to, it is more comforting to believe that an evil organization did this and swung the vote than it is that simply that people don't agree with you. Mm. So, you know, Pete, I don't think you have to be on one of the extremes of politics to get sucked into conspiracism. I do think you have to, I mean, it does help to have strong beliefs, but you can have strong centrist or strong liberal beliefs.
One of the things that I found interesting that you mentioned there is in terms of the kind of echo chamber that, you know, I think to a degree we all perhaps exist in, particularly online. And one of the things that it is interesting with the way that conspiracy theory messages are produced into these echo chambers is how slick they have become over the past few years. The ability of people who propagate conspiracy theories to be able to manufacture them in a very professional way. They look like something that is made by someone who almost has some credentials, simply because of the production values that are associated with the content. How much of an influence do you think that has on the way people respond to conspiracy theories, the kind of slickness of the presentation of them, or the way that they are presented that seems, you know, almost as if they could be made by an official or a more established, a mainstream news network?
So I am wildly speculating on my own account here. I haven't seen any research on this. And there isn't like a huge chunk of this in the book or anything, but my instinct is, I don't know how much impact it would have on what you yourself believe, because we are all capable of believing things no matter how, I mean, a lot of the early websites, you're probably a bit young for this, but a lot of the early websites I remember on the internet, back when you used to have, like, you know, bits of flashing text and terrible font choices and bad colours and so on, that sort of stuff kind of feels like we still had this stuff going around then. Mm. I don't think it necessarily, if it accords with what you want to, or what you find interesting, or what you want to believe, I don't think, I mean the quality of the product only sort of makes a marginal difference. I think probably, though, where it does have a much bigger impact is into the transmissibility, in that, like, you know, whether an individual who is already prone to believe something or not buys into something probably isn't affected that much by the quality of the web design. but once it gets to the point, it's like you're trying to sort of essentially recruit people on Facebook or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think probably at that point, something that looks professional should go, hey, look, here is a real news source backing this up. Yeah. It probably does help them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I find interesting as well in the book is the distinctions that are made between different types of conspiracy theories, event conspiracies, systemic conspiracies, and super conspiracies. Could you just give sort of a brief oversight of what these three different types of conspiracies mean and the different ways that they can lure people in and make people believe them?
I'm going to be honest, that's one of Tom's chapters, so I get a bit hazy about some of this. But I mean, basically, there's sort of an escalation dynamic. Event conspiracies are the quite discrete ones. So, like, I don't know what's a good one. The Brexit one we were just talking about. It's like, you know, it is about affecting a particular thing at a particular at a particular event at a particular time with a particular goal. It's all quite specific. Systemic conspiracy are the ones you get into where it's something like, I know the New World Order for, or the Bilderberg Group or something. There are these people that actually have their hands on the levers of power in a lot of different ways, and a lot of different events can be linked back to them. Super conspiracies are when you start getting a bunch of these things bunged together, which you can see with something like QAnon. Which has started absorbing all these different conspiracy theories from all over the internet, effectively, like the blob. It just kind of swallows all these things, and then the people involved kind of pick and choose the bits that kind of fit with what they want to believe.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that Simpson screenshot of, like, you know, Milhouse pointing at the blackboard with everything on it. It's like, it's that. That is a super conspiracy. And the reason I'm a bit hesitant is I never entirely got my head around quite how you can tell when something's gone from systemic to super, because they obviously have a lot of characteristics in common. But I think one way in which the super conspiracy kind of more... They're sort of almost sort of more like evolved super predators. Like, they can kind of like pick things up or drop them at will, depending on which bit is propagating best.
Yeah.
Which is like how genes function in evolutionary terms. Yep. You know, it's like so that's obviously that's. You can see at that point you've got quite a different dynamic from debates over who shot JFK.
Yeah.
So there are these things do operate on very different scales and in very different ways, I think.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found interesting reading the book and obviously looking at the news at the moment and things have been happening in the news over the past few months and years is that we have instances when we see people, you know, feel shock at political leaders, people who are, you know, either President of the United States, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, using conspiracy theories and essentially trying to manipulate them for their own ends or use them as a political point. But given if you've read the book, you know, anybody listening will know that this has been something that's been going on for a very long time. Political leaders throughout history have used conspiracy theories to a greater and lesser degree at different points. Do you think that there's something that the sort of the brazenness of them, particularly in the examples of, say, like Trump or Viktor Orban or Bolsonaro, the kind of brazenness of the use of conspiracies that has taken people back to a certain degree that makes them feel as if, oh, this is something that is, you know, brand new leaders dwelling on conspiracy theories, when it's not, it's something that has been done for a very long time?
I think to some extent it's because, though, we do talk about how these things have come and gone over. I mean, we've got quite a lot of fairly detailed stuff in the history of the US going back to like the 1890s or something. You can see it coming up on a fairly regular schedule. But there are conspiracy theories in the book that go back far beyond that. I think the earliest one in there is the Roman general Germanicus starting a conspiracy theory about his own death in the first century AD, because it took him like a month to die. And he may have just been dying of, like, you know, cancer or something, and he didn't really have the medical science for it. But he thought he'd been poisoned, and he went around telling people who he had been poisoned by, the Emperor Tiberius and his agents. And so based on very little, that spread. And that's obviously, you know, that's 2,000 years ago, this stuff has been. But anyway, I'm sorry, I'm getting distracted again. I think this stuff does happen. It's cyclical, but the cycle is long enough that you have to be quite old to remember the last period of conspiracism in politics. Go back to the US, and you kind of look at, you know, that run of assassinations, you know, JFK, RFK, Martin Luther King, and so on in the 60s. And the civil rights and anti-war protest movements and the state's attempts to undermine those. And then Watergate. And all that stuff happens in this sort of, you know, 10, 12-year period. That obviously led to a huge amount of conspiratorial thinking, some of which is still with us today. But to have been politically active in that period and to remember that, you probably need to be in your 70s now. So a lot of it is simply that most politically engaged people today do not remember the last time we went through this cycle, basically. And also I think some of it is, I think a lot of it is linked to economic anxiety, basically. I mean, what we were talking about a few minutes ago with, in the way that people latch onto these things at times of insecurity. We have for nearly 15 years now been in an economic crisis, essentially. You know, you can be in your mid-30s and basically have never worked in during the good times. Obviously, that is going to lead to a lot of the insecurity that stems from that feeds into politics in a lot of ways. We have seen the rise of populism, or we have seen a resurgence of racism and prejudice, because, you know, when people are feeling insecure, they are more likely to blame people who aren't like them, and so on. And I think, again, the conspiracism is kind of a part of that. What this means for how we get past it, I have no idea, because it doesn't currently look like there is not a boom around the corner, you know? I don't know. I sort of think, like, when the economy and living standards start getting better for significant numbers of people, a lot of people who lean on this stuff now will not anymore, and it will become a less effective political strategy. And suddenly there will probably be votes in you know, optimism. For example, I mean, you look at, like, Ronald Reagan, who's very much a politician of the right. I don't think he was particularly conspiratorial. He was just like, hey, vote for me, everything will be sunny, I'll make your life better. And that wasn't true for, like, the entire electorate. But nonetheless, that was the pitch. That's a very different kind of scenario to kind of Nixon's silent majority thing, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. We're coming towards the end of the podcast, John. It's been great to have you on, and I have one final question. We've obviously been talking about
the lizards did it.
I heard that
answers your question.
Well, no, it's not actually the answer to my question. It may be the answer to my question. My final question is this: if you had to convince everyone in the world of a particular conspiracy theory for one day, which conspiracy theory would you want to convince them of, and what impact do you think it would have if everyone in the world believed it for a day?
I mean, so again, a point we make a lot in the book is that there are real conspiracies, and often conspiracy theories end up dismissing those real conspiracies. So, for example, there was a conspiracy to do 9/11. It was not, so far as anyone can tell, one in which the US government was complicit, but there was a conspiracy nonetheless. Al-Qaeda was a conspiracy. And yet 9/11 truther movement popped up to kind of argue for the alternative conspiracy theory. So in that, there is a conspiracy to undermine the environmental movement, I think. I think that's a real one. I think there are oil companies do dodgy things to kind of hide inconvenient research and so on. So if I could convince everybody for one thing, it would be the existence of that conspiracy theory, and that we shouldn't listen to them, and that we should bloody do something about the fact the planet is burning. There we go. Is that an answer?
I think that's a fantastic answer. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast, John. If people want to buy the book and find out more about you, where should they go to do those two things?
So I'm basically a Twitter account with a human being hanging off the back. I'm at John Elledge, JONNELLEDGE. I also these days have a newsletter, which which paying subscribers get every week, and non-paying subscribers get things slightly less often. But there's still a lot of material there. And that's johnjoenn.substack.com. Also, you can find me in having opinions in the New Statesman quite a lot.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast, or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.